Good morning. It is 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Kathleen Dunn. Cyberspace is on our mind this hour following a news report last week in the Wall Street Journal that cyber spies from a number of countries have broken into the U.S. electrical grid and, while there, left behind software programs that could be used to disrupt the system. Apparently, they haven't done any damage, at least not yet. During the first part of the program today, we'll be focusing on what actually may have occurred with the penetration of the electrical grid. Our guest during the first half hour is Jim Lewis, a director and senior fellow in technology and public policy programs at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And then after 10:30, we'll change the focus more generally on threats to cybersecurity around the country. Your calls and comments are always welcome. Do you think that these threats are the stuff of science fiction, or do they strike you as something very real and threats that we should take seriously? And if we should, what can we do about it? We're in our Madison studios today, so you can use our toll-free number to join in. The number is 800-642-1234. You can also join us by email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Jim Lewis, good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, and I have to tell you that I was on vacation last week, and I was reading a novel, a thriller, you know, an airport book, and I kid you not, part of the premise of the book was it was set in Hong Kong, and somebody had broken into the electrical grid and was playing havoc with the system. And a friend of mine that we were staying with said, "Did you read this report about cyber spies breaking into the grid?" And it was a very confusing moment for me. And, you know, it's one of those things where sort of fiction meets reality. So could you tell us what you think may have really happened?
Sure. This is not something new. I mean, what was new in the journal story was that federal officials confirmed that it had happened. Electrical grids are a very popular target for foreign militaries and for attack. It's something that people routinely expect to bomb or to try and blow up, and what cyberspace does is it gives them a new kind of weapon. So I wasn't particularly surprised to hear that the Russians or the Chinese or maybe some others had mapped out our electrical infrastructure, found some vulnerabilities, and planned how to attack it in the event of a crisis. And that's pretty much what happened, is they came up with a new weapon and they figured out how to use it.
Let's go back to the bit of news that did catch your eye, though, the fact that federal officials confirmed that it happened. If it's nothing new and all of a sudden the news is that federal officials confirmed this, what has changed that all of a sudden that they have done so?
Two things have changed. The first is that there's a lot more attention to the insecurity of our networks, and a lot of that has to do with the new president. He made this an issue for his campaign. He's identified it as one of his top five national security challenges. So the new administration is trying to pay more attention to this. It's always hard to get the government to change course, but the fact that the president has talked about it, that he's interested, has helped people pay attention. The other thing that's changed is we're embarking on a great new adventure called Smart Grid, and Smart Grid depends on computer technologies, and guess what? They're going to make us even more vulnerable. I like Smart Grid. It's the thing to do. It's environmentally better. It's more efficient. It's better economically, but it's easier to attack.
Okay, let's break this conversation up then into what I'm going to call Old Grid, and then we can get into Smart Grid in a second. What do we have right now? And, when you talk about computers being part of that, if you could explain to the audience how that all works, because, you know, when we toss around the term electrical grid in a rather cavalier fashion as though we know what it is, as we can point to it and say, there it is. But it seems a lot more ethereal to me.
One of the questions I've always had, too, just is if the new thing is smart grid, does that mean the old thing was dumb grid? You know, and it's not really dumb grid. Both of them depend on computers. It's just that the new technology makes even greater use. The old system, it's a series of generating stations, power plants. You all know what those are. Mm-hmm. They connect over these high-tension power lines that are formed into regional grids. There's multiple regional grids in the U.S. that are somewhat independent, and we got a demonstration of this in 2003 with the New York blackout.
Right.
Inside the power plants, and there are large machines that generate electricity, and those are now controlled by computers. One of the things that was exciting last year was that researchers at the Idaho National Labs were able to show that you could remotely attack these machines, remotely attack their computer control systems, and basically make them shake themselves to pieces, right? Because you're attacking their control system, their nervous system. So the old grid is vulnerable because of its control systems, right? Now, we haven't changed that with smart grid. The control systems are still vulnerable, and that's actually what the foreign powers probably have mapped out. How can I get into a power plant and destroy equipment there? The smart grid adds to this monitoring capability. So now there'll be a computer somewhere, maybe in your house, maybe at the electric company, that tells you how much electricity you're using, when is a good time to turn on your appliances to make the best use of low electrical rates. It is smart because it depends on computers, and that's good. The problem is while we have become more efficient, we've also become more vulnerable because those computers are, for the most part, no more secure than anything else.
And, you know, the grid is one of those things that nobody thinks about until it's not there anymore.
Yeah, and it's you know, I know in Wisconsin every once in a while when there's a big snowfall, sometimes you'll get a few days of a power outage, but it tends to be limited. Think about that spread over a multi-state region and, you know, lasting a couple of weeks. That would really have some significance. The thing we always say is that, you know, foreign powers shouldn't think that the ability to cause a blackout will let them win a war with the United States. So this isn't something that they're going to stake everything on. You know, I'm China, and I've decided to attack America by making the traffic lights blink on and off. But in a crisis, in a situation, they could say, you know what, we want to stress out the Americans. We want to have them be overloaded, and so we're going to turn off the electricity in key parts of the country and make them have to deal with that at the same time they deal with whatever crisis we're in. And that's really the risk.
And here's the question. If I were a layperson at home right now, I'd say, well, what are the Russians or the Chinese or whoever it is, what are they doing in my electrical grid, you know, here in Madison? How did they get into that? Don't we have a firewall? And what are they doing?
Well, you know, the nice thing about the spread of the global Internet, which it's really only been about 15 years, is that because of the way it works, we're all connected to each other. We're all basically neighbors. So for a Russian agent, for example, to intervene in Wisconsin, it's like he was living right next door to you, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of time, in terms of access. We're all connected now to one single network, and that gives opponents a new opportunity. You could say, and it would be fair, when did we figure this out as a government? And the answer would be probably about 1996. That's when you saw the first report out of the White House that said electrical grids are a target. And, you know, I it's a little embarrassing, not for me, but for whoever was in charge, to say, well, in the intervening 13 years, we haven't actually managed to do anything to change that. So, you know, I don't know, what phrase do you want to use, asleep at the switch?
I mean, well, let's explore that a bit. Has the federal reaction been literally nothing, or just sort of baby steps, lip service sorts of things?
It's a mixture of both. There's been a reluctance, certainly in the last 8 years and in the last administration, to force companies to do things they didn't want to do. There was a reluctance to use regulatory authority. And so in that sense, the electrical grid is no different from Wall Street. I don't know if that's comforting or not.
Lately, I would say not.
Yeah. So we made a choice not to force companies to improve security. Now, the companies have tried on their own. And the problem with that is that some companies do really well, right? Some companies are great. They have secure networks. They have secure facilities. Other companies, they haven't done so well. And, you know, you could say, well, if my company in my neighborhood is doing a good job, I don't have to worry. The problem is we're all linked, right? So when the Russians or the Chinese or whoever probes for weaknesses, they may find a weakness in a neighboring electric company, not in yours, but they could be able to use that to bring down not only the target, but you as well. So it's the linkages that have made our kind of laissez-faire approach problematic. We don't know who's secure and who isn't, and that leaves us vulnerable.
And it does raise the question, you know, in terms of an electrical company, why you would allow yourself to become that vulnerable. I mean, if there's no real news value to this story that people could somehow get in here, It doesn't seem to me it would be in your best interest as a generating company that you would want someone poking around in your business.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't think about it. When the internet appeared, it was everyone liked it. Nobody thought about security. This isn't just a problem for the electrical grid. It's wonderful. You turn it on, you can do amazing things, you can save some money. And so companies went ahead and did that, and they didn't think about security. And to be fair, we don't expect companies to be the people responsible for dealing with foreign intelligence agencies. They're hopelessly outclassed. So for them, they didn't know. They wanted to save money. I don't blame the companies too much. I think what I'd say is, you know, this is one of those things like car safety where you really needed the federal government to step in and say, we have a new problem, a new set of risks, and everybody has to do the same thing to mitigate those risks.
And now we have a new administration trying to take a look at solving a problem that's been around for a while and is not going to be easy to solve in any case. Is there anything that can be done quickly? And then secondly, what should people be looking at for the longer term?
You know, the problem is that the new administration has really focused on this issue, but they have, first of all, an inheritance that is both the Bush administration and, to some extent, the Clinton administration, an inheritance of not doing anything. So it will be hard to do very much quickly. It's hard to just, you can't just swap things out on a moment's notice. The other problem the new administration has is they're having internal battles, and there's people who say, the most important thing is the recovery, or the most important thing is America's ability to innovate and to do new science and research, which is true, but then the caveat they add to that, and so therefore we shouldn't worry about security, is where we run into trouble. So not clear to me that there's anything we can do quickly or easily, or even that we'll get total agreement on it. But to their credit, this administration has taken the problem more seriously than any of their predecessors, and that leaves me with some hope.
And following last week's news reports in the Wall Street Journal, and then, of course, it filtered out into the rest of the media, do you sense on a slightly grander scale than just the administration that perhaps members of the public are becoming aware of this as well?
Yeah, I think a couple things have helped focus people's attention. I mean, everyone worries about identity theft. I think it's perhaps overstate. Like so many of these threats in cyberspace, it's easy to overstate them, but people worry about that. The botnets that people know about, where your computer is remotely controlled by unknown foreigners, the whole configure thing, you know, again, a little bit of a bust. The world was supposed to end on April 1st, but didn't. But what we found out is the configure people, maybe it was a big joke. They said they were going to turn off all the computers, and instead what they did is rob people's bank accounts, which probably was more satisfying for them. So there's a whole set of things, particularly on the cybercrime side, that I think are helping to focus people's attention.
We're talking about cybercrime, cyberspace, cyber hackers, and particularly as it relates to the electrical grid, following a report last week in the Wall Street Journal that federal officials confirm that foreign Russians, Chinese, others, have been poking around inside the electrical grid, and while they've been there, they have left software programs that haven't done anything yet, but conceivably, if the time were right, if the place were right, if the right person were on the other end of that switch, something could happen. We're talking for the first part of this hour with Jim Lewis and about what happened, why it happened, and where we go from here. In the second part of the hour, we're going to be talking in more general terms about threats to cybersecurity. We'd like to hear what you think, too. And we have some open lines for you. What are your thoughts on cybersecurity? Is this overblown or is it a very real issue? 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.com. www.theideasnetwork.org. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here today filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The time is 21 minutes past 10 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Kathleen Dunn. And this hour, we are talking about the electrical grid and cybersecurity for the U.S. and for the rest of the world, I imagine. During the first part of this hour, we're talking with Jim Lewis. He is a director and senior fellow in technology and public policy programs at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we're talking about what happened, what news reported last week about the penetration of the electrical grid in the U.S., talking about who did it, how it happened, why it happened, and what those consequences could be. We'll be taking your calls as well. 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number. Join us by email, talk@wpr.org. Jim Lewis, one of the things we haven't talked about yet too awfully much is on the other side of this. You know, we've mentioned Russians, we've mentioned Chinese, we've mentioned all sorts of suspects, I guess you could phrase it. But in your estimation, who is it likely that is out there who is interested in us?
You know, we've got basically three sets of people who are playing around with this, and for me, the most important of them are foreign intelligence agencies. And, you know, whenever you start to tell spy stories, it's easy to sound a little paranoid or a little nutty. But one thing to remember with espionage is that it's not something, you know, despite 24, the public may ever know about. So with this story, we've seen a little bit of a peek at a very intense intelligence battle between China, Russia, and the U.S. that is occurring in cyberspace. The second set of opponents might be cyber criminals, and people run into sort of low-end cyber criminals. You know, when you get those emails from Nigeria saying that you are the beneficiary of the will of the late king or something, those are cyber criminals, but those are the low-end. The high-end folks, they're as sophisticated as some government agencies, and they focus on banks, on the electrical grid, on making money. And we have a real problem now because you have a flourishing network of criminals, very often in the former Soviet Union, who have kind of a sanctuary. If they commit a crime in Madison, there's no way to arrest them because they'll live in St. Petersburg. The third set is, you know, everybody else, teenagers, terrorists. They haven't really done anything. You know, people play around sometimes on terrorist websites. You see them say, hey, what if we did this? And nobody picks up on it, right? It's not something that interests them, fortunately, I would say. So our really two big concerns are foreign intelligence services, foreign militaries, and cyber criminals.
You know, and that cyber criminal element is really, I think, at least the way I'm seeing it, the big change. Because, you know, you think about a different country, whether it's Russia or China, whoever, and there's you think there's some kind of rational thought there. There's a state that you can look at and sort of go to and talk to and do something with. But the cyber criminal is operating in a whole different spot. And as you say, there's sanctuary. They're sort of hidden. They're beyond the reach of formal government in a sense.
Yeah, that's true. Their motives are pretty straightforward. Their motives are money, right? So we know there's been at least a couple incidents where criminals have gone through the internet and used cyberspace to threaten power companies that they would turn off their systems unless they were paid money. In other words, an extortion racket. That hasn't happened in the U.S., but it's happened outside the U.S. So, you know, you have a very skillful group that's discovered a very low-risk way to commit crimes.
And I don't know if this is a good analogy, but I'm thinking of the Somali pirates. You know, here's somebody operating outside of the fringes of a formal state, and yet, you know, they're trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, no, that's a good example. The difference is the Somali pirates actually face a little risk. They have to go out in those small boats. They could run into the U.S. Navy or the French Navy. You know, the cyber criminal's doing it from the comfort of his bedroom, so it's a much more attractive way to commit crimes.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Kathleen Dunn today. We're talking about the electrical grid and what is going on in terms of cybersecurity. And we had an email we had a phone call from somebody who couldn't stick around, but they wanted to know why our electrical grid is on the same internet as everybody else. And I imagine that's rooted in history.
It is, and to some extent, you know, it's a bit of a blanket statement to say that it's on the same internet. Some parts of the electrical grid are, some aren't. If you'd looked 20 years ago, what you would have found is that the companies were using proprietary networks. You know, maybe they would have a phone line that they would keep open all the time, or they would have their own system for controlling, and they'd use their own software. That was more secure, but it was less efficient. And what's happened is, you know, what we call IP-based, Internet Protocol-based systems and technologies are just so much cheaper that the companies said, hey, look, here's a way we can save some money. So it's been good for the consumer to the extent that we have moved to the Internet because it's more efficient, but it does create this new risk. And we're at fault is we took the benefit from the efficiency, but we didn't pay attention to how to mitigate the risk.
Now, as we move forward and as people want to be paying attention to this story, as normal people read the media, what sorts of things ought they be, should they be paying attention to? The news that federal officials have confirmed this is a big deal. In your estimation, what would you consider to be other big news that we might see coming out in the next weeks or months?
In the next couple of weeks, probably at the end of the month, the White House is going to release the results of its 60-day review of cybersecurity policy. It's not clear how that will play out because, as I mentioned, there's some intense turf battles going on. You know, it's unfortunate that turf is the big issue, but with luck, we'll get a very strong report with some solid recommendations on how to make the situation better. I think you'll see the White House announce that probably at the end of the month. There'll be congressional hearings. There's been some very funny hearings where electrical companies have had to come in and explain what they have or have not done, and it's usually what they haven't done. So I'd watch for the White House releases. I'd watch for the congressional action. Those are things that are going to happen, and if the stars align the right way, we could end up better off as a result.
If the stars align, but it's, is it a big if in your mind, or are we getting more definite as we move forward?
We're moving in the right direction. The question is the pace. Will people say, cybersecurity has always been an orphan, right? Oh, it's invisible, so I don't have to worry about it. And this year, it hasn't been an orphan. It's people, you know, things like this surface and people pay attention. But the question is, how long will it take us to move to recognize that we now depend on computer networks and we have to treat them as seriously when it comes to security as we do anything else?
And do you see that growing awareness? We've talked about it in the administration, but the administration is just one part of that big puzzle. When we get to congressional hearings, do you think we're going to see a true understanding, or would you see more political bluster, more, you know, partisan lines, that sort of thing?
Political bluster, never.
Okay, good. That's what I was hoping you were going to say.
You know, I've been doing kind of an informal poll because I have been paying attention to this problem for a while. And so I've been asking people when I talk to them, hey, you know, do you get it? Do you understand what's going on? And the short answer is I overestimated how widespread the public understanding, the congressional understanding, even the understanding within, you know, the agencies that aren't directly involved. People still tend to think, this is something I read in an airport novel. I saw it in a Bruce Willis movie. You know, it stars Godzilla. And you have people who exaggerate wildly. People say cyber attacks could bring the U.S. to its knees and turn it into a third world country. Well, that's nonsense. And when you get, you know, Die Hard 4 and nonsense, people tend to write this off. And what we need to do is get folks to realize, just like other intelligence issues, just like other military issues, this is now a real problem. I wouldn't say that we're there yet.
Well, Jim Lewis, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks. This was fun.
Jim Lewis has been with us for the past half hour, a director and senior fellow in technology and public policy programs at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we've been talking about a report in the Wall Street Journal last week that federal officials confirm that Chinese, Russians, and others have been in the U.S. electrical grid, in cyberspace, and while there, they left some software surprises for us. Not a surprise because we found it, of course, but things that could have done some damage. And we've been talking with him about what happened and why. We're going to turn to our second guest right now who is joining us. Alan Poller is with us. He is the Director of Research at the SANS Institute. They provide computer security training, among other things. Poller is the Director of Research there and, among other things, is responsible for a number of projects, including the top 10 security menaces of the coming year. Alan Poller, good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Happy to be here, Gene. Thank you.
Well, it is great to have you along. And if you heard there, we've been talking for the past half hour about this report in the Wall Street Journal last week regarding the penetration of the U.S. electrical grid and the fact that federal officials have confirmed that it happened. And in your estimation, I want to start, I guess, with that bit of news. In your estimation, is that big news that federal officials are actually saying that, yeah, this actually happened?
It's enormous news. I enjoyed the interview you did with Jim, too. It really brought the color out in the fact that it was news.
Mm-hmm. And do you place the blame, he at least placed part of the blame on where we are now, on what has happened over the past couple of administrations, and the fact that the news that people can get into our electrical grid is not particularly new, and really very little has been done about it?
I think the key reason we haven't done more is that we've used what Jim and I both like to call faith-based security, where we've had faith that the people who sold us the computers would sell us computers that were hard to break into, and the people who provided electricity wouldn't connect their computers to the Internet, and if they did, they'd make sure that they were deeply secure, and that faith tended to be misplaced. And I think government has discovered that it does have a role, that there has been a failure in the market, and that government really does need to help make sure that the systems that we rely on every day for our power and telecommunications and our lives are safe.
Now, right at the end of the interview, one of the challenges Jim was referring to was that challenge when you take Die Hard 4 and reality and you sort of mash them up, that people get confused. And so in your estimation, how seriously should a layperson be taking this? Obviously, at the government levels, it sounds like people got to pay attention to it. They have to take action. We have to do something. But if I'm just sitting around my house listening to this interview right now, what do I have to worry about?
I'll answer that question. It's not a pleasant answer. For the same faith-based reasons that the power companies were vulnerable to attacks, most of our home computers are vulnerable to attacks. And the way that plays out is that we visit a website that we think is safe, even a government website, and hackers have broken into that website and caused it to send data to our computer when we visit it that makes our computer become a zombie. And then once they have control of our computer, they can do one of three things. The most common one is they use it to send spam or to send lots of traffic to it's called denial of service, where they'll take down a banking site or they'll take down an online gambling site and use extortion to get money from that site to stop the flood. But the more harmful ones is that they'll put a keystroke logger on. That's what Configure seems to be doing now.
Mm-hmm.
They'll put a keystroke logger on, and all that means is that when we type Bank of America and then our password, even though our password looks like it's protected because it doesn't come up in characters, the keyboard knows which characters we typed, and the keystroke logger records that and then sends it off to files in different countries where they record these, and then other people use that data and empty the bank accounts. The way they do this, they move it to another account in the same bank, and then they empty that other bank account, or they use our brokerage accounts for pump-and-dump schemes, a lot of crimes along this line where they'll take all the stocks in your account because they had the keystroke logger, they took control of your account. They take all the stocks in your account and sell them one morning and buy a penny stock, thereby pushing the price of that penny stock up. But they had bought millions of shares before, and so they then sell their shares at a profit, and your brokerage account drops back to zero. So personally, your computer tends to be a very vulnerable place to be, and the main reason it is that the people who it's not something you as a home user need to worry about. It's something that two people should be worrying about, and they're not. One is the ISPs who connect you to the internet. They don't want to take any responsibility for this. And the other is the people who actually sold you the software in the first place, who don't want to take responsibility. And at some point, this is very much like the automobile. The people who built cars did not want to take responsibility for crashes. They said drivers make crashes. Well, that was true, but seatbelts and better bumpers did a lot to mitigate the damage. And the people who supply the software and who connect us, the internet, have the same responsibility, but it won't be until government steps in that they'll ever take that responsibility on.
Yeah, and if you use that analogy, that's exactly what happened with automobiles. I mean, they had to require seatbelts, had to require improved braking, and so on and so on.
Exactly. And if you were in Washington in the 50s, apparently, the most powerful lobbyists in Washington were the ones from Ford and GM, by far. They had easy access to the White House anytime they want. Exactly the same thing is true of the computer guys now. They're the most powerful people in Washington in all of IT areas, and they just work really hard to make sure the government doesn't ask them to take responsibility for what's happening to home users.
This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. And we're following up on a story from last week's Wall Street Journal about break-ins on the U.S. electrical grid by people in other parts of the world who have broken in and have left software surprises for us. And we've got some phone calls. We do have some open lines for you, if you'd like. 800-642-1234. During this part of the program, we're talking with Alan Poller. He is the Director of Research at the Sands Institute. He is the Director of Research there and is responsible for a number of projects, including the top 10 security menaces of the coming year. Let's go to the phones, and Bill is with us from Brilliant. Hi, Bill.
Hello. How you guys doing?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question is this. If foreign intelligence agencies are trying to do this or are doing this to us, are we trying to do the same thing to them? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, Bill, thanks for that. I appreciate the call. And let's see if our guest is back. And are you there, Alan Poller? Alan Poller is not here just yet. We are in the process of getting him back. But, you know, that's an interesting question Bill brings up, because we can assume that if we are getting visitors from other countries, that our U.S. intelligence services, cyber criminals that may be living here in the U.S., are also interested in getting into computer systems in other parts of the world. And so it does bring up a question on a whole variety of levels that we should see if we can get an answer to. So Alan is with us back. And Alan, I don't know if you heard the question.
I didn't. I got lost for a moment. It was a hardware problem.
I was going to say a computer glitch, but
exactly,
too much
right.
of a joke. The question came from Bill in Brilliant, who wanted to know if it's, we're getting visitors from other countries, cyber criminals from other places. Are we visiting other countries as well? That is his question. Are we interested in the electrical grid in China or Russia or wherever we might be interested in them?
The specific data on that's really classified, but there are 25 countries that have very active cyber national defense and national intelligence cyber programs around the world, and we're clearly one of them. So the answer has to be yes.
In other words, that they're not, while it's classified, we know that they're on the payroll and we can assume they're doing something.
Right.
Okay. Let's take a break right now. We're going to take a break. And when we return, we'll continue our discussion with Alan Poller about cybersecurity and what the future of that looks like, and talking about some of the problems that face us, some of the challenges that face us here in the U.S. as well. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 19 minutes before 11 o'clock. Coming up after 11, Jim Packard is in, and he'll be talking spring allergies this morning with UW-Madison Hospital and Clinics Dr. Mark Moss. That's coming up after 11 o'clock. This hour, we are talking about cybersecurity. Our guest during this part of the program, Alan Poller, the Director of Research at the Sands Institute. They provide computer security training for a whole variety of organizations around the country, around the world. He is also the Director of Research there and is responsible for a number of projects, including the top 10 security menaces of the coming year. Let's head back to the phones right now and go to Milton, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Milton.
Hi, I have three quick points. The first point is that this is not news to anybody who follows IT or national security. For whatever reason, it's become sexy to the media, and now we're hearing about it. Second point, things are way worse than they're letting on. The inherent nature of the internet just is like a sieve, and pretty much no matter what you do, the hackers are always going to be one step ahead of you. And we have foreign software companies who are writing software for things like our grid, for our military and other sensitive areas, and there are known associations with foreign intelligence with these software companies. They know it. They never talk about it. And the last two things are that these foreign companies, can get into our nuclear power plants and our voting because they write and administer the software. So, comment.
All right, Milton, thanks for the call. And Alan Pollard, a couple of things there. His first point that this isn't news, we've talked about that a bit. But what about Milton's second point, that the situation is worse than many folks are letting on?
Well, I think that the current administration has stepped up to the problem by recognizing that it's worse than perhaps had been let on in previous administrations. So I'm very optimistic that with Melissa Hathaway and other people who are actually leading a national effort that we're paying attention to it. The we can never do anything about it, they're always ahead of us, is actually not entirely true. It's an arms race. That's absolutely true. But there's a fascinating thing you can do about it, and it's much better than regulation, although we need regulation. It turns out that most of the things we buy at home and the utilities buy are also bought by the government, meaning the government runs power companies and the government runs dams and all sorts of things that are done by commercial organizations, phone networks. And it also spends about $70 billion a year on running all those things, running the IT for those things.
Okay.
And they've already demonstrated once that by using just a little bit of that money, they can persuade the vendors to deliver much more secure versions of their technologies. And in doing that, they made that same technology available to all the other users around the country. So the concept of we can't stop them, we can't win, is true, but we can actually make it much more difficult for the bad guys to get in if we run our networks more securely and the people who sell software to us deliver more secure software. And that's where the government can lead. They can lead by buying only software that is written securely so that the rest of us can buy it too. Just the nature of software that if one person has bought it, everybody else gets it too.
And his third point, he talked about, Milton mentioned, sort of related
foreign
to
foreign manufacturers.
Well, yeah, getting into either foreign manufacturers of software, but also talked about other cyber criminals breaking into nuclear power plants and controlling voting processes in the U.S. We heard a lot about that in the last couple of elections.
I think the concept of foreign is a red herring. I definitely think that there are attempts by foreign governments to get into the manufacturing process and to control computers that they can use when those computers get delivered to governments around the world. That's mm-hmm. happening for sure. But it can happen just as well if a country gets some of its engineers hired into American companies. So you can't decide that the way you're going to protect technology is by not buying from foreigners. Because it just doesn't work. It doesn't protect you adequately at all. What you do have to do is build new ways of testing software and hardware to find those hidden things within. Very hard to do. Probably the hardest problem we have in cybersecurity is to find what's called the persistent presence, where they've gotten in, they've burrowed deep. They might be in the firmware, not even in the software. That's the sort of software in hardware that they deliver, and we have to find them. And it's a massive challenge. And one of the ways you do it, actually, it's interesting, you don't so much look for it, but it has to phone home at some point. It has to communicate back to the mothership. And you do a much better job of watching the communications between your systems and the outside world than you've ever done before.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and Jim is with us from Oshkosh. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I'm a casual but frequent user of my computer, the Internet. I'm technologically challenged.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use it for online banking, but I order books and other goods and services using a credit card. Am I at risk as a small user, someone insignificant, if in general and specifically, what are my risks and what can I or should I do about it?
That's a pretty big question, Jim. I'll put it to our guest.
It's a great question. Yeah. It's the one my children ask me. It's the right question. Let's answer it on two levels. One is, what's the risk to you? And two is, what should you worry about? The risk to you is very small economically or behaviorally, meaning everybody who really understands the security risks on the Internet continue to buy things on the Internet using their credit cards. So no matter how much you know, the consensus is there's not much risk. There is a problem in bank accounts, in doing banking on the Internet, and that is a problem that comes out when your computer is taken over and keystroke loggers are put on your machine. And there's some absolute keys to stopping that. One is a program called NoScript. If you don't use Internet Explorer but use Firefox, you can install NoScript, and it stops the scripts that like to take over your machine from working on your machine. But the worry about using credit cards should be zero. You're not at risk from using your credit cards. In fact, you're much more at risk. You're equally at risk if you just use your credit card in the store, because almost all of the credit card theft happens where the credit cards are stored together, not while you're using it on the Internet. So it's back at that merchant where they have thousands of credit cards, some of which came over the Internet, some of which were used in the stores. That's where they get stolen. So don't worry about it on that end.
Is that just a case of that's a much easier target? And, Jim referred to himself as being sort of insignificant, I think, and they just see a bigger target at a retailer like that.
You make some money if you have thousands and thousands of credit cards. You don't make much money on one. I think they're worth about 11 cents on average to sell a credit card number right now, maybe 7 cents, somewhere in that range. You can't make any money there, and these people would rather steal a million of them.
It's interesting to hear the comments about online banking because, you make those comments just as I probably have something at home today from my bank urging me to go online and do all my banking there. Because at the same time you're talking about some of those risks, there is a giant push to get all of us online at one level or another.
Yeah, we definitely go ahead and do that. But talk to your bank about not allowing, setting up your account so it doesn't allow money to be shifted out. Use it to look at things. Use it to find out where you are. But right now, given the security of PCs, it's not real sensible to let people move money out of your account because when someone takes over your machine, that allows them to move money out of your account as well.
And I heard you just say the letters PC, which brings up the eternal PC versus Mac question. Are Macs any more secure?
Macs are a lot more secure, but they're not perfect at all. And the reason they're more secure is that there are more PCs, and people have spent more time looking for the vulnerabilities. But now, in the past year, we've had a whole slew of equally vicious vulnerabilities in Macs that we've announced. And then we get religious zealotry when we publish the weekly report of all the critical new vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we publish one on the Mac, people think we're hurting their baby. But it's the only reason the Macs were safer is that there weren't as many of them, so the attackers didn't look as hard, but they're starting to look now.
And, I mean, anybody who's been in the middle of a Mac versus PC meeting knows exactly what you are talking about. Sarah is with us now from Richmond, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you for talking about this important topic.
Sure.
I'm going to switch to the internet. I know a lot of businesses, my small business does a lot with the internet, a lot of online storage and stuff. So two-part question. Number one, how is it that you can keep the internet safe from any kind of attack or sabotage, major things, not just these little worms that are always out and about, and yet keep the free speech and keep what's already out there? And the second part is there a way to do that? And if there is, what would you suggest if you were setting up that kind of a system? What would be the first two or one thing that you would suggest has to be done?
The answer to that was actually the subject of the keynote address in a National Science Foundation meeting in 2005, which was focused on how do you allow for anonymity and get trust on the internet. And it turns out probably the answer is along the path of a red and a green internet. The red internet is the one we have now where you know the old joke on the internet, no one knows you're a dog, the old New Yorker cartoon.
Yeah.
On the red internet, it's the world we have now. You don't know who you're talking to. You don't know whether the software that you're getting is actually coming from the person that you expect it to be. You don't know the users of who else might have infected the website that you're going to visit. And the green internet, there's complete identification. So no one gets on it unless both their computer and they themselves are completely identifiable. And that kind of attribution cuts down radically on the chances for economic and other crimes. It would cost a little more to do that, so you'd do it for all your banking. You'd use the green internet, maybe for important work with your own company. If you're trying to work at home and you want to work safely, you'd use the green internet. And the question is, how do you keep the two separate? And that's the big issue. That's the design issue. How do you physically separate them? How do you virtually separate them? How do you keep a file that you make on one from coming over and infecting the other one? And that'll be a long design problem, but I think that's the direction we'll go.
But in the meantime, there are plenty of challenges out there. And, you know, you published this top 10 security menaces list, which I haven't had a chance to read yet. And I'm wondering if on that list there is anything that people wouldn't expect to see. And if so, what might an example of that be?
I think the worst one is the, right for right now, it actually started last year, but we didn't announce it until middle of the year, is that the sites that you thought you could trust are not as trustworthy as you thought they were. For example, state government sites, a Department of Homeland Security site, the United Nations site, all were sites that were infecting your computers and allowing people to put malicious code on your computers. So we used to teach people only go to sites you trust.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was the people who wrote the programs that set up those sites had never learned to write secure coding. It turns out the colleges don't teach secure coding. They teach you to write code, but they don't teach you how to write code that doesn't let hackers in. And because of that, millions, literally millions of websites are vulnerable. So I think that the big one is this idea that I'm just going to sites I trust, and that's getting me infected. And when you say, well, what do I do about that? That's what I mentioned. I mentioned that NoScript using Firefox,
right.
NoScript. That's what keeps those things from making your computer go where you don't want to go.
So now when you're saying those sites that people thought they could trust really aren't trustworthy, you're not saying that the state employees or whomever wrote the code. You're saying that they set up this website, say, at a Department of Transportation or whatever, and then somebody else came in because it was sort of an unsecure site, left some code in there, and then all of a sudden it morphed into an untrustworthy site.
Right. In fact, what they did, they used something called SQL injection, code for something where they can put data on the site. They took every piece of text that was on that site and they added a little script to it. So when you think you're getting text, when you sort of answer and you click on something and text comes to your screen, hidden in that text is a script that makes your computer go off to another site where a keystroke logger can be downloaded. So they actually took advantage of the fact that whoever wrote that application had no training in secure coding. It's one of the great national weaknesses is we don't teach our programmers to write securely.
Okay, we've got about a minute or so left before we have to leave. And in that minute or so, could you take a few seconds and, you know, tell listeners if they're you know, obviously, I imagine this show has raised more questions than it has answered for many of our listeners in terms of security. If you're at home right now, if you are worried about cybersecurity, what sorts of things ought you be doing to your computer to make sure it's about as safe as you can make it?
The main one is the way you use the Internet. Don't click don't download files unless you expected the file to be there. Meaning, don't just have somebody send you an email that says, "Hey, click on this to get this file." That's the way you get infected most often. Don't accept. Don't go to websites that are not ones that you actually know to be good. Those are the two things that most importantly protect you. And then the third one is try to put the no script option in your browser so that you download it. It's you can get it from Google, and it just protects you a lot more fully. But there's no way right now, until the ISPs, until the people who sell you internet service actually start taking responsibility for protecting you, there's no way people at home can be absolutely confident that they're not going to be infected.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank you for your time, Alan Poller.
You're welcome.
All right, Alan Poller has been with us for the past half hour. Before that, we were joined by Jim Lewis, and we've been talking about cybersecurity for the past hour or so in the wake of news last week that federal officials have confirmed that Russians, Chinese, others have been inside the U.S. electrical grid, and they have been leaving surprises there for us. If you would like a copy of this program, you can go online at our website, WPR.org, and find it in our archives. Robert Schrader produced this hour, and we had on-air production from Rhonda Fanning. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.